Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 10 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the poet and non-fiction writer Gwyneth Lewis and the poet, memoirist and historical novelist Joanne Lindberg talk with Julia Kopis about their experiences of mental illness and its effects on a writer's life.
Gwyneth Lewis was National Poet of Wales in 2005 to 2006 and has won a number of prizes for her poetry, including in 2010 a Society of Authors Cholmondeley Award for a distinguished body of work. Her two memoirs are Sunbathing in the Rain, a cheerful book about depression, and Two in a Boat. Joanne Lindberg has been a Royal Literary Fund Fellow at Magdalen College, Cambridge. She also began her writing life as a poet, and besides poetry, has published The Woman Who Thought Too Much, a memoir about obsessive-compulsive disorder, which was shortlisted for the Mind Book of the Year Award in 2011. More recently, she has been working on a novel based on the life of Queen Anne. Gwyneth and Joanne joined me to discuss the memoirs they've both written about their experiences of mental illness. I was curious to know how those experiences had fed into their writing lives, and to find out what they made of the link between creativity and mental illness, the age-old notion that, in the words of Lord Byron, we of the craft are all crazy. I just want to start by talking in general terms about your experiences of mental illness. Jo, I wonder if you could explain for us the mechanics, if that's the right word, of obsessive behaviour. In your book, you give an example of a fear of being burned by a hot saucepan, and you describe how in some people the sequence of thoughts that we all go through, what you call the saucepan hot ouch sequence, doesn't turn itself off after the danger has passed. So if I had an obsession that focused on saucepans, how might I feel?
Well, you would feel constantly aware of that saucepan hot ouch, and you would feel the attendant fear. So the way I think about it is, if you imagine that when you are in danger of burning yourself, a warning light comes on in your head and a warning siren, beep, 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 and normally you would move away and it would switch off. It doesn't switch off, so you are permanently in that state of anticipating being about to be hurt. Mm-hmm. And so you're very anxious, and you would do anything you can to switch that off because it's a horrible feeling. So it might start like you will move all the saucepans down into the cupboard, and it might start you'll move out of the kitchen and close the door. Anything to appease this thing that's driving you mad.
So that's the behaviour that comes from the obsessive thought.
Yes, so the behaviour, if you like, is a solution that brings its own problems. The behaviour is a strategy to stop you feeling the unbearable anxiety and to switch the thought off.
So that avoidant behaviour is a way of keeping things under control.
Yes, it could start by being, oh, I've got a thought of a saucepan, I'm going to touch the table in front of me four times, that makes it go away. The irony is that by doing that, you're taking it seriously, you're reinforcing it, and you're feeding into it. So your very act of pushing that obsession away actually makes it stronger.
So you're sort of feeding the anxiety.
You are. That's exactly what you're doing.
So avoidance seems quite logical and sensible up to a point.
Yes.
But the problem, I suppose, is that we need to take a certain amount of risk in our lives. And as you point out in your memoir, you say, loving makes us so vulnerable. Every day we face the risk of losing the people we love. And you reveal in your memoir that several close members of your family died in quite a short space of time.
Yes.
I was wondering if there was a sense in which the bereavements that you suffered increased your desire for control over your life and therefore exacerbated your symptoms. Or is that not how it works?
I think it can work in that way, and for a lot of people a traumatic event can either trigger it in the first place or make it worse. I know that certainly where my son's concerned, my desire to kind of control the risk that he's in can get out of hand sometimes, and I have to allow myself to allow him to do things that I really don't want him to do, because it wouldn't be fair for his life to be circumscribed by my anxiety. And as he gets older and he gets on a bike and he gets more independent and he goes on, God forbid, outward bound courses, I have to let him. I don't want him to go. I can't stop myself from saying things like, be careful every time he goes out the door, and that's a ritual. And every time my husband goes out the door and is going to cycle somewhere unusual, I say, put your helmet on. And they both roll their eyes and they go, yes. But
so
I have to do it.
That's a nice way of dealing with it. So you've got the sort of normal parental anxieties, but sort of tenfold or...
much more intense. I joked to someone that the first time my son walks the park by himself with her son, that I was going to have to be sedated. But I wasn't entirely joking.
And Gwyneth, we learned in the introduction to your book that according to the World Health Organization, 100 million new cases of depression are reported every year. And you describe the sensation that comes with depression of losing the self. Can you tell us a little bit about how it feels to you to live in the shadow of depression? Are there warning signals that let you know that a new episode might be imminent?
I think, first of all, about the statistics of depression, you say that that's reported cases, 100,000 new reported cases every year. There are many, many unreported cases. Mm. And I suspect, by talking to doctors, that the 1 in 4 statistic about, the, you know, 1 in 4 of the population is going to suffer from depression, I think that's an underestimation.
Mm.
So that there are people suffering from it who don't even know, A, that they're suffering, they know they're suffering, but they what they're suffering from, and B, that there's help available. So I think it's an epidemic. How does it feel? There are symptoms. I mean, our GP does a kind of sheet, which is helpful because it actually is objective.
Mm.
And one of the symptoms I find of depression is that you think, oh, if only I were a better person, I wouldn't be feeling this awful. So when you have objective tick, 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 have I got this symptom, have I got that, it's very useful. How does it feel?
I mean, are there signs that you have learned to look out for that an episode might be, a serious episode might be imminent?
I've learned to read my personal signs. I think everybody has different ones. One of my, a dead giveaway is not being able to cope with email at all, not being able to respond, just feeling overwhelmed by the demands of people. I'm never great on email anyway, but, you know, if I don't respond at all, that's a signal. Overdoing things is both a cause and a symptom, because if I unconsciously know that I'm going to crash, I try and get everything done before the debility sets in. But it's also, exhaustion is one of the, for me, one of the primary triggers. I was thinking as Joanne was talking that the same reaction to an obsession that can be problematic in OCD, it's the same in clinical depression, in that you feel that in order to make yourself feel better, that you have to do something. And in fact, you have to do it right now. You have to climb a mountain, bake a cake. These are recurring obsessions of mine. Clean the house. And of course, you're not capable of doing any of those things, and they're not going to make you feel better. So they're like a self-destructive safety mechanism.
Mm. Now, both your books have a narrative autobiographical thread running through them. But Gwyneth, yours is broken up at frequent intervals from various sources, from Nietzsche to Yeats to the Daily Telegraph, which you use quite a lot. Why did you decide to structure the book in that way?
A very straightforward reason. One of the symptoms of depression is that your concentration goes. So, I mean, I can normally read a heavy book quickly. When I'm depressed, I don't want to read anything.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm incapable of focusing on even a newspaper. So I thought that if I was going to write a book for people who were recovering, that it was essential to keep the chapters short and that to give them many outs. You know, you can take in little nuggets and think about them and then put the book down. Of course, I think it helped that I was recovering as I wrote the book. So I had an innate sense of the timing of what I could bear to write.
I wonder if it also reflects somehow the fragmented nature of depression itself.
Yes, that's a really good point, because your body may be lethargic, but actually your mind is so overactive, and your emotions, that in fact you're exhausted by thinking so much. I was just thinking about Joanne's OCD, about how exhausting it must be.
And Jo, you talk about your illness in terms of Freud's tripartite model of the psyche, the id, the ego and the superego, which, if I've got this right, is the judging, evaluating part of the self. That's the superego.
Yes.
And you describe the constant need that you have to mollify your superego. On one occasion, you relate an internal conversation that you have with your superego, which I'll just read out. "Time was pressing," she, that is your superego, said. "I needed to find a career ladder and get on it, or everybody would think I was a failure. My ego muttered something about wanting to write. The superego snorted contemptuously, like a great aunt taking tea on Rosh Hashanah," which is the Jewish New Year.
Funny, we've got our superego are related, you know. Oh. They're in the same family, for sure.
I think mine may be too, actually. I love that idea of the superego as a sniffy great aunt. But given that we all have these warring elements inside us, are you saying that the internal battles are particularly pronounced for OCD sufferers?
I think so. A big component of OCD is perfectionism, fear of being judged, fear of making a mistake, and that can manifest itself in and with depression too, I think.
I've got all those things.
Yes, yes, it's a very, I mean, a certain kind of malignant perfectionism is a very good predictor of mental illness of various kinds, unfortunately. And I think it goes wrong when it becomes, you know, to use a Freudian word, persecutory. Mm. And the voice becomes too loud and too bullying, and you're doing things that are actually not good for you in order to placate it.
That's a good way of putting it.
But what hope have we got, poets? Because you do need perfectionism.
Yes.
Of a kind, but you did say malignant perfectionism.
We do, but it's when it leads you to paralysis and is destructive that it's wrong. If it's the sort of taking infinite pains kind of perfectionism that's productive and enjoyable and that has flow, that's fine. But when it gets so loud that it stops you dead and every time you try and write a line it goes, well, that's rubbish.
But that you taking know. Infinite pains, I mean, as a, we're all three of us poets.
Yes.
I mean, that's something I would think that every poet could relate to.
Yes.
And it is sometimes malignant and destructive, I think, anyway. While you were writing these memoirs, did you find yourselves writing less poetry or more poetry?
No poetry. I think if you're writing something which requires a lot of yourself, I think I can only do one medium at a time. So it's a question of allocating the prime creative time for me, which is, it's the milk that's got the most cream in it, first thing when I write in the morning. So whatever the primary work I'm working on gets that cream. And so that can only be one thing at a time. If you want to finish a book, I'm not able to dabble in anything very much.
But about finishing a book, I mean, when something has that narrative thread, as your memoirs do, you need to pick up on that thread and continue it. But if you're writing a book of lyrical poems,
yes,
self-contained little projects of their own.
With a long project, you're holding a file open for a long time. There's a lot of pending, which has all the attendant anxiety, I've used that phrase again, that comes with it, that you're holding for a long time. I can't write both at once very well. And I would use the analogy of a first generation computer that had to be reconfigured and rebuilt between every different task. I find my poetry shaped mind is very different from my book length prose shaped mind.
Right.
The one is not fit for the other purpose.
You see, I don't see it that way. I think they are the same model for me.
Mm.
And I think that there is a narrative element in a poem.
Within a poem, yes, that I was talking about sort of separate poems moving on from one lyric poem with its own subject to a completely different poem. It's interesting that you both responded like that, because I remember interviewing Helen Dunmore many years ago and asking her the same question about the prose and the poetry writing. And she said, no, it's fantastic because I never get writer's block. If I can't think of what to write next for my, you know, my novel, then I just go and write a poem. And I was absolutely gobsmacked by that reply.
Poets who can write novels and novelists who can write poems are mysterious creatures to me. I think their brain is constructed slightly differently. They're a breed apart.
So you're making a distinction between fiction and non-fiction in terms of prose writing.
You can use many of the techniques of fiction to make a memoir vivid and readable while still keeping to events in a chronology that actually happened. But I do think that, for me, the constellation is poetry and non-fiction because they circle around a fact of a feeling even, whereas fiction is then looking for some different kind of corollary. It's looking for a different way of conducting that world or reproducing that fact, emotional fact. So it calls for very different skills.
Yes, I would agree with that. I am writing a novel at the moment, but it's a novel based on historical fact and historical record and historical people. And I don't think I have the kind of mind that could conjure up a whole new cast of people and move them around in a way that a novelist does. I would say I do have to start with something. I mean, even if it then veers off in a totally strange and fantastical or even fictional direction, I need my feet on the ground somewhere.
Now, one thing that struck me while I was reading both these memoirs is that you can both be very funny. Jo, your OCD becomes something of a gooseberry at one point when you say, Chris married me and my disorder at the end of August, and then the three of us went off on a honeymoon to Venice, the perfect venue for generating both romantic memories and imaginary near-drowning incidents. And Gwyneth, is it true that your husband Leighton once said to you, there are two of us in this relationship and they're not both you?
Yes, it is true. He's a great dispenser of gems like that, and good at cutting me down to size, you know.
So in a broader sense then, what is the relationship between depression and humour? Can humour be a benefit to the depressive?
I think it's a kind of very valuable last-ditch defence. I think even if you don't have a sense of proportion, you can still have a sense of humour. And I know my poor brother, who took his own life, something that happened very, very noticeably in the months leading up was that he lost his sense of humour.
Things are pretty serious when that goes.
I think so, yes. I find there's definitely a link with me between humour and feeling low. When I was at university, a friend of mine said, I can tell when you're really down because your letters get really funny.
How interesting.
Isn't it, though? Yeah.
So, moving on to the subject of medication. Jo, you make the surprising statement at one point that you believe you write better when medicated. And you go further than that. You confess that, and this is a quotation from your book, it would be fair to say that I choose to continue to take fluoxetine, which is the generic name for Prozac, isn't it? Almost as much for performance enhancement purposes as I do for treatment. Can you say a little bit more about that? What do you think is happening there?
I think it's just loosening up something in my head. It's just making it less rigid. It's making me flow more easily. It's making me get over those hurdles more easily that my superego puts there. Just somehow it gives you that energy and that drive forward. I mean, in my case, it does. Different people react to it very differently. I wouldn't say it made me happy, but it does give me that mental energy I need to clear the blocks.
So you're saying two things there. You're saying that it both drives you forward and also helps to silence those blocking messages and voices that you're getting from.
Yes, it's almost the same thing, because you just keep barreling forward. You just have that momentum and it's enough to take you past.
And Gwyneth, you were also prescribed an SSRI, a drug in the same family as Prozac. But in one of your poems, you have your psychiatrist speaker say, yes, I'm in favour of using pills, but my main job is to translate pain into tales they can tolerate in another language. They, meaning the patients. Mm. I know this is from a sequence that's about the dying of the Welsh language as well as about mental illness. What does your psychiatrist figure mean when he, or is it a she, says that his job is to translate the patient's pain into stories that they can tolerate in another language?
I think what the psychiatrist is talking about there is therapy. I see writing poetry and therapy as similar, only in the sense that the consequences of not speaking truthfully are serious. And, of course, as a poet, they're not unrelated. But I think it's also saying another thing is that, yes, the SSRIs are very, very helpful, but I believe that therapy is just as important, and also that physical exercise is just as important. Mm-hmm. So I think it's crucial to say that we need to attack depression with all the tools at our command, and that medication is only a part of that.
Now, you're both well-known poets, and thinking specifically about mental illness as a subject matter for poems, I noticed, Jo, that you've written directly about your life experiences in your poetry. Well, Gwyneth, your poems on the subject are less obviously autobiographical. Your approach is more oblique, if you like. We've already mentioned, for example, the sequence of poems that's subtitled Memoirs of a Psychiatrist, where you consider the subject from the medical professional's point of view. I'm interested in the fact that you've each chosen a slightly different approach, and I wonder what the reasons might be for those different approaches. Jo, perhaps you could start by telling us about the pros and cons of the autobiographical approach.
Surely. I've been thinking about it a lot lately. Sometimes I feel a bit of shame about the directness of my work. It seems to be a bit of a not quite such a poetic way of going about things. But I've realised, as I've learned more about myself, that I need to do it that way, because I think it's a Wittgenstein phrase, how can I know what I think till I see what I say? Because I can't process it in my head, I process it on the page, and so the clarity for me is the end point, and it's a clarity that I'm seeking for myself. But of course, the downside of it is you are making yourself very open to the reader, and also you're doing something apparently so simple that the work that's in it isn't apparent. And that can affect the way people read you.
So the finished product can, you think, come across as more simple?
Yes. Because I'm writing to achieve a state of clarity, I'm writing something that quite often be assimilated at one level on one reading, which a lot of poetry can't. Because it takes less effort to read, it can make it look as if it took less effort to write.
Interesting. And how about you, Gwyneth?
I regard all the poetry that I write as displacement activity from feeling anxious or puzzled or happy or saddened. So in a way, you know, I've been dealing with the issue of mental illness in the means that I work for a very long time, for as long as I've been writing, perhaps. So it doesn't need to be explicitly about it. Mm-hmm. And perhaps I have been more guarded. But, I mean, after writing Sunbathing in the Rain, I there's less reason to be guarded because my cover's blown. But before then, I would write about things in code. I'm originally from a small community of Welsh-speaking people. So, you know, you don't always want to be open about these things.
Telling the truth, but telling it slant-wise.
Yes, or telling it completely hidden-wise. But, I mean, I didn't know what was going on, or anybody else could spot that, perhaps.
I wonder if your new poetry will be slightly more open in that sense.
I doubt it. I think I'm not naturally a person who needs the approach direct. It's a question of just temperament.
Yes.
I tend to go slant. It's just like the way I walk. That's how it goes.
Now, Gwyneth, there's a magical moment in Sunbathing when you describe leaning out of the window as a teenager in Cardiff, looking back at your bedroom. And you explain that that's what poetry has always been for you, a way of giving yourself a point of view outside of your own seeing, as you put it. Is there a sense in which depression gives you a new perspective, to a sense in which it allows you to look from the outside in? Because, I mean, although depression results in self-absorption, it also, I think, removes you from the world that's going on around you or going on out there, and it places you in that sense in the role of outsider. And I wonder if at times that might be useful in some way.
Well, I mean, what you just described is actually what evolutionary biologists say that depression is for. If you look at groups of monkeys or chimpanzees, somebody suffers a loss of status or an injury or something, and they withdraw, and it's to adjust their standing in the community and to become used to that. So you've described very accurately what genetically depression may be for, and I'm pretty convinced by that. It's a period of adjustment. It is like somebody knocking you out so that you can come to terms with an altered reality. But I wish I could find ways earlier and more less inconvenient and painful ways of doing it. Mm. Perhaps if I wrote more poetry or better poetry, I don't know, it might do the trick. But I do my best.
Yes. It's almost an alchemical thing you're describing, like the Jungians would have it, as you go through all the stages, including the negredo, which is poo and destruction and horrible, but it's a necessary stage in order for that reintegration and new synthesis to happen. Doesn't make it not horrible.
No, it is horrible. Mm. Yeah,
it's horrible, but that idea that there may be something that can be gained from bouts of mental illness makes me think of one of the quotations that runs through your book, Gwyneth. You include a quotation from the German poet, Rilke, from his Letters to a Young Poet, where he says, "Why should you want to exclude any anxiety and grief, any melancholy from your life, since you do not know what it is that these conditions are accomplishing in you?" Are you suggesting then, Gwyneth, that depression can have certain benefits for the sufferer?
I am. And what I'm trying to argue in the book is that depression needs to be seen as part of a cycle of creativity, and that we're not just being creative when we're up and producing. I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about depression either, though, because the less depression one feels in life, the better, as far as I'm concerned. And I would definitely reject the idea that you need to be mentally ill in some way in order to write poetry. No, you need to be well in order to be producing art.
Now, there's quite a well-documented connection, as I think you say in your book, Jo, between mental illness and creativity. And the Romantic poets embraced this image, didn't they? Mm. Lord Byron went so far as to say, "We of the craft are all crazy." I wonder, though, if there's anything to be gained from prolonging this idea of the poet as somebody far removed from the mainstream, whom perhaps we should even be a bit wary of, like the poet at the end of Coleridge's Kubla Khan. "Beware, beware, his flashing eyes, his floating hair." First of all, do you agree with this link that is generally accepted between creativity and mental illness? Do you think there's a danger in overstating the connection? I mean, after all, mental illness is just as common in at least other artists, composers, musicians and so on, but also perhaps in the general public as well.
I think I veer about, because there is undoubtedly a correlation between creativity and high levels of recorded diagnosed mental illness. I don't think one can get away from that. I wouldn't say that the mental illness is caused by the creativity, or that the creativity necessarily helps the mental illness. As Gwyneth has said, when you're ill, when you're really ill, you can't do anything, it gets in the way. I also have a bit of a difficulty with the idea of the poet with the floating hair and flashing eyes, partly because one can't actually live like that. And I think when you're female and looking after a house, and also if you've got a child, you can't live like that. I cannot go into the playground with floating hair and flashing eyes. I cannot set myself apart as a vagabond from society.
And would you like to?
There are moments, but actually I find it quite interesting to work with the contradictions between those two cultural constructions of housewife and mother and poet, and write on that margin.
But they are constructions, aren't they?
Exactly, they're constructions.
Yes. I mean, that's how the Romantics wanted, it's about perception, isn't it? They wanted to be perceived in that way. And when you say about the higher incidence of diagnosis amongst poets and other creative writers and artists, you know, that could be down to a number of causes. They might take themselves to the doctor more frequently than other people.
Well, the fact is that it's more acceptable, I think I said this in my book, to be mentally ill and be an artist than it is to be mentally ill and be a doctor, lawyer, surveyor, accountant, whatever. There's less shame in revealing it. It's not going to do your career quite as much harm. Because of that perceived link, it's an acceptable place to be. And I don't know whether people wind up choosing that path for that reason or what.
Perhaps we have the romantics to thank for the fact that it is more acceptable.
Yes, although
to be a mad poet.
It can lead people to think that the madder and more out there you are, the better your writing is. And that's not the case. You know, the harder you work at it and the more skilled, the better your writing is. Yeah. And that's a function of a mind working healthily.
What about you, Gwyneth?
My view of this is quite different. I said she with flashing eyes.
I've seen some research where actually the statistics go completely the other way and say that artists are less prone to mental illness. In fact, it's very surprising, given what we do, that we don't suffer from more mental illness because we're engaged in work that's not financially well remunerated, that is very competitive, doesn't have a high social status, and also that requires isolation. So I think that we actually do extremely well on this, and that you could equally say that writing is a sign of health.
So would you say that you need a certain level of robustness to survive those very adverse conditions?
Definitely. Yes. And I think that we're more robust than other people because we're used to living in that kind of landscape.
Yeah, I think it's important what you said, that actually the conditions under which you operate as an artist are not conducive to good mental health. And that's not directly connected with the creativity yourself, but the social and economic conditions under which you work.
Yeah.
Yes, and not just those social and economic conditions, but also the nature of the work itself.
Yes.
That you do have to look within.
Yes.
And Gwyneth, you talk very vividly about depression in terms of dark and light. But darkness for you isn't a straightforwardly negative thing. And your light and dark metaphors made me think of Theodore Roetker's poem, In a Dark Time, which begins, "In a dark time, the eye begins to see." There's a touching moment in your memoir when Leighton, your soon-to-be husband at the time, brings you a present of a winter-flowering cherry tree, and you suggest that a winter-flowering tree is the perfect gift for a depressive. It's an act of faith, you say, that something will stir in the dark. In that sense, do you think the poet has something particular to offer those suffering from mental illness in terms of describing the condition using images?
Possibly, because once you have a purchase on the condition or a metaphor, it makes it easier to understand and therefore easier to bear. In describing depression is like trying to get a handle on fog, and anything that blows a little of the fog away is helpful.
That idea of imagery helping somebody to visualise a mental illness and therefore bringing some comfort with it also makes me think of Sylvia Plath's poem, Mushrooms, and the way that mushrooms gather strength in the dark. And that poem ends, "We shall by morning inherit the earth, our foot's in the door." And there's tremendous power in that image, isn't there? I can imagine that being consoling to somebody in the throes of depression.
Yes, if they could read. I think, you know, what happens is that you get this recognition in retrospect.
In terms of timing, although you're not able perhaps to read these things while you're in the middle of an episode, they're useful, aren't they, to store up for the future?
Well, they are. I found, for example, malaria to be a good metaphor. You know, occasionally I come down with this fever. So what do you do when you have malaria, aside from drink gin and tonic for the quinine? No, but you put yourself in your pyjamas, you treat yourself kindly, and sip soup until the fever passes. That makes sense to me. So I think you have to find your own store of useful metaphors.
Yes. I sometimes think of mental flu. And the other one that I think of is weather. You know, it's a spell of adverse weather.
That's a good one, I think. Yeah.
And will therefore pass.
Exactly.
Jo, your poem Travelling Light, which you include in your memoir, ends with the godly joy of cleanliness, the pleasure of being stripped bare and blameless, are born again with just one suitcase on the right road. That last line, I don't know if you intended it, reminds me of the last line of the Louis MacNeice poem, Entirely, where he says, there is no road that is right entirely. Now, the title of your memoir, Jo, is The Woman Who Thought Too Much. That presumably refers in part to the obsessive thoughts that are associated with OCD. But if MacNeice is right, there is no road that is right entirely. Do you think some of the problem for people who are prone to mental illness of this kind, in any case, might be that they have more trouble than most accepting this, that instead they're restlessly searching for the right road? How far is thinking too much part of the problem?
I think it's the problem when what you're trying to do is desperately think your way down the right road to the right destination. If you just enjoy the process and the playfulness of it, you can't think too much. If what you're doing is fixating obsessively on a hypothetical right answer and ruminating and trying to reach for this thing that is always going to recede, that's when it becomes too much.
And finally, I was wondering, you both write in different genres now. You started off writing poetry, you still write poetry. Do you think of yourselves as predominantly poets or non-fiction writers or just writers in general? How does that work, Gwyneth?
Well, I think I'm fundamentally a poet. And, you know, if I'm not getting poetry written in some shape or form, I feel very uncomfortable internally. In a way, I see other forms as an expansion of poetry, because there are ways that you can make poems like theatre or libretti. Yeah, I mean, I think I go about it fundamentally like a poet.
And Jo?
I've come to think of myself more as a writer simply for the amount of hours I put into prose as opposed to poetry, which lately haven't been many. But I feel a sense of guilt about it whenever I start wanting to not describe myself as a poet, the way I feel a sense of guilt about being a non-practicing Jew, because there's a sense of poetry being some kind of religious devotion and some kind of duty to yourself that I don't get with prose. And I feel guilty when I move away from it. So on some very fundamental level, that's my vocation.
We were discussing Joanne Lindbergh's The Woman Who Thought Too Much, which is published by Atlantic, and Gwyneth Lewis' Sunbathing in the Rain, published by Fourth Estate. The poetry collections of both authors are available from Bloodaxe Books.
That was Gwyneth Lewis and Joanne Lindbergh in conversation with Julia Copus. You can find out more about Gwyneth on her website at www.gwynethlewis.com, that's Gwyneth spelt G-W-Y-N, and about Joanne on her website at www.joannelimburg.net, that's Limburg spelt B-U-R-G. And that concludes episode 10, which was recorded by Julia Copus and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 11, we have Gwyneth Lewis again on what it's like to be a poet, and polymath writer Simon Ray on his multifaceted career. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.